Welcome to Worker Movement, a podcast dedicated to the working class, a podcast dedicated to raising class consciousness. This podcast is for you, for us, for the worker.
I've only really paid attention to one White House press briefing during the Biden presidency, and it was on March 1st. Here's another excerpt. This time, the discussion focuses on vaccine supply.
So when the president of Mexico meets with President Biden a little bit later today, he's expected to ask if President Biden would consider sharing part of the U.S. coronavirus vaccine supply with his country. Is this something that President Biden is considering?
No.
The president has made clear that he is focused on ensuring that vaccines are accessible to every American. That is our focus. The next step is economic recovery, and that is in ensuring that our neighbors, Mexico and Canada, have similarly managed the pandemic so that we can open our borders and build back better. But our focus is on his focus. The administration's focus is on ensuring that every American is vaccinated. And once we accomplish that objective, we're happy to discuss further steps beyond that.
The CDC also recently announced that people that are vaccinated do not need to wear a mask when around others that have also been vaccinated, nor when they are around unvaccinated people from one other household. Is this good policy?
That makes no sense. A, you can't scientifically get to 100%. I mean, if it was caveat was 100% of those that are able to be vaccinated is vaccinated, I guess. But that seems like even that would be an insane tall order because you can't even get to there. I would say until herd immunity is reached is probably the more scientific approach. The second part of this, though, is that, no, this is a terrible idea. Like, absolutely. Because the people that are probably super spreading it around are not the people who are staying at home all the time. It's the people out in the streets wandering around. And I don't know why you wouldn't try to help areas that were the hardest hit, like impoverished countries, because they're the ones that are going to be super spreading it all over the place. And the longer we have unvaccinated people that have the disease in their body, the more chance there is for mutation. This is a terrible idea. And it just points to the just lack of any common sense thought or systems level thinking anywhere.
So to use a really simplified example, let's say you have a vat of water and you take 3 cups. And I don't mean like volume cups. I just mean like you take a glass and you scoop out some water. Then you vaccinate each one of the 3 glasses and then you pour all the water back. Does that help you?
Yeah, no. It's like if you want to dye that vat red and you scoop it out and you pour in dye into one of the cups and pour it back in there, now you have like lightly tinted water and there's not enough molecules to actually make it red. It doesn't make any sense. Because the people that are vaccinated who then get a mutant strain who's not protected anymore, I mean, why'd you vaccinate them? This doesn't make any sense. The U.S. should ultimately, because they're a global superpower, seize the means of production, crank out vaccines, and vaccinate the entire world like tomorrow as fast as possible. Because we looked at Brazil, we have the Brazilian strain now that's making some vaccines non-effective. It spreads faster. We have the U.K. variant, which has the same variation that the Brazilian variant has. We have 7 different strains in the United States now, or whatever that number is. Like, it's a literal battle between vaccinations and viruses right now. And guess who always wins? The virus. Unless you stamp it out right away, the virus will win every time. You gotta get everybody vaccinated in one fail swoop, because if not, you have to close your borders immediately. So that's it. You can either close your borders and never let anything in or out, or you can attempt to mitigate the risk of people coming and going by vaccinating everybody that would be crossing borders.
So this speaks to the idea of globalization versus isolationism. So we'll quickly just define what globalization is, and it's largely an economic model of I'm in the United States and I want to build cars. So I'm going to globalize the construction of cars by exploiting people in China and exploiting people in Mexico so that cars are created more efficiently for the U.S., and consumers in the U.S. From an economic perspective to making money, this works as an economic idea. It requires everybody to work together to make this car. I'm not saying it's fair, equitable, or anything, but from an economic perspective, it leads to the construction of a car efficiently in a distributed manner that allows for optimizations in regionality and acquiring natural resources and minimizing costs of employment of people in foreign countries that don't have labor laws. It's an economic concept. So fast forward to COVID, where we're actually all collectively that vat of water as a globe. and we have globalization, and certain developed countries want to turn to isolationism at this point. So the U.S. saying, well, we're going to vaccinate only our population and fuck everybody else until we're vaccinated. That's effectively the opposite of globalization. And it does two things. It absolutely fucks over the third world and the global south, but the U.S. doesn't care about that. But it also damages the standing for globalization. If you're a third world country and you are looking to the U.S. and saying, hey, look, we made all those cars in exchange for being exploited, we thought you were going to have our back when a pandemic came. And the U.S. turns their back on this car manufacturing company or country and gets totally fucked over, what incentive do these foreign countries have to now interact with the U.S. now that they've gone to isolationism? Or nationalism would be another way to frame it.
I'm glad you use automotive as one of the best examples of what globalization is, because there are certain parts you just don't want to ship around because they're made out of like foam and it's just basically air. So you have to do those, you have to manufacture those regionally. But there's other things like electronics that you don't have to manufacture regionally. You can manufacture globally because they're a dense pack out, which means they can ship for relative small amounts of money per part weight, like electronics. And then you have sheet metal and you have a bunch of other heavy stuff that all go into this vehicle, and you can essentially exploit labor and environmental laws no matter where you are, as long as you're paying the wages of people in that country. So globalization is based purely on the exploitation of labor, 100%. And as a leftist, I mean, there is no ethical consumption under capitalism, but there is a small amount of guilt when buying something that happens, right? Because you know what's going on in this. And if you're in manufacturing or you're in engineering at all, you know what kind of exploitations happen. Another prime example of why exploitation is so wild here is that there are certain actions that are not profitable in the U.S. that you can do in other countries. And that's like rework. So the rework part means it failed quality control, and now you can do some hand tuning of the thing at the end. So you make electronics and you go through the soldering process, the reflow, and one in five parts doesn't have the right soldering on part of the chip. You can pay someone to sit there with the magnifying glass and solder all day long that same bad chip component continuously while you figure out the process. In the United States, it may be too expensive. So that's why you see, this efficient use of labor is basically just exploitation of low labor costs.
And this is generally the problem cited by NAFTA and the TPP. These are all free trade agreements, and they're done under the context of, well, we're all going to work together as co-participants in the global economy, which on paper is absolutely fine, but it's literal exploitation. And it's exploitation for both sides of the equation as well, where jobs leave the United States to go elsewhere because exploitation is more readily available elsewhere. So that leads to job losses and it leads to exploitation. So this free trade concept is a problem, and it's manifesting with COVID because nationalism and isolation become the go-to standard for rich developed countries because they want to take care of their population and they don't give a shit externally. And guess what? They never gave a shit externally. But now they're forced to make this decision and overtly say, we don't give a shit about the global south, which is why you have the White House secretary saying, we're not going to help Canada or Mexico. We're going to take care of all of us first, because USA is number one, America first. But this time it's with the Democrats, so it's fine.
I mean, they could just pack drones full of vaccinations and shoot them into Yemen for the Saudi Arabians. That might work better.
Oh, we're going to hold Saudi Arabia accountable, though, for killing a journalist by... Oh, I'm checking my notes. Actually, we did nothing. Sorry.
We could talk about globalization, and this is one of the key issues here, is that you're only of value if you are valued to capitalism. The journalist only is of value to the United States because he was basically a paid adversary of the royal crown prince. So he's only really important to the United States because he was basically a CIA operative. He may not have been legally a CIA operative, but when he's fed information that only comes from spy agencies spying on the crown prince, it's kind of hard to know where that data came from, right? That information normally comes from a service of another country because they have access to all that information. So again, under capitalism, you're only as good as what you can provide to the capitalists themselves. And at some point in time, you become like a democratically controlled fascist state because the people that are elected are already acting in the interest of capital, and the capitalists don't actually have to tell them what to do.
And we saw this play out in Texas, where you had the giant industrial failure of the power grid. And this was largely because Texas wanted to do the isolationism thing and say, Texas first, we don't want to interact with your federal regulations because we want to make more money. And you saw the creation of the ERCOT Energy Board, which is basically run by nonprofits or was privatized. It didn't have a lot of government oversight. And this led to a massive wide-scale power outage, and now you're seeing a water crisis. So isolationism in the COVID case doesn't help the population. Even if 100% of the U.S. population is vaccinated, there's going to be a mutation. And in Texas, even though you're not attached to the power grid, you don't have power and you don't have water. But you don't have to wear a mask anymore, so Texas is back open.
Back at it. Here we go. We're Texas. I don't get that. But the people there are suffering because the, I'll call them the resource managers at this point in time, you know, the Abbott and his cronies at the local level have passed all this deregulation, and it's because they were able to survive so long without a 100-year storm. It's the fact that they were caught off guard that they lost. And part of that, too, is the fact that they were probably growing faster than the grid was upkept. And because they weren't capacity-driven, they were service-driven, they didn't have to predict future capacity usage and actually upgrade to that. And this is what the strain is. Oh, it's hot? It's cold, whatever happens to be, we got to turn up more energy usage, it strains the system, boom, done. And this is a cause, again, by isolationists, deregulation, individuals who want to hoard as much natural resources as they can. Right? We are proponents of open borders because arbitrarily defined lines of who lives where is what defines nationalism. I mean, it creates the isolationist, it creates the imperialistic viewpoint of the world in which I want to control your land over there, but I don't want you taking part of the riches in it, right? And then it's also the colonialism idea. We are better for you than you are for yourself, and now we control your corn or whatever the hell we're trying to take or your natural resources, and there's nothing you can do about it. And I'm sorry, Puerto Rico, you can never be a state because we've basically raped your land for so long, we don't want it back. I want to make sure everybody knows that, you know, we are open borders, but we also know that everything happens locally. And so it's really important that you not only preach the idea of welcome everybody in your community, but also welcoming strangers within your community, because that's how we grow as a society. And bitching and moaning about people crossing a border 40,000 miles from your house doesn't help anything, right? If you live in Ohio, the people that are illegally crossing the border in Texas, guess what? That doesn't affect you at all. And if you live in Texas, the people crossing the border doesn't even impact you anyways, because there's nothing they can do. Because there's no take your jobs movement down there, because there's no jobs to really take. Like, it doesn't make any fucking sense to me. I'm going off on a little bit of a tangent because it makes zero sense to me. If you live in Georgia and you can't pick your tomatoes, guess what happens? You can't make money. And you can't pick tomatoes without migrant farmers. And if you crack down on migrant farmers, tomato prices go up. That's what happens through exploitation.
So immigration is largely a byproduct of globalization and this exploitation elsewhere. So you see immigration from foreign countries that are effectively war zones or heavily impoverished or heavily exploited, and they want to migrate to the U.S. because the U.S. is great. But in a non-zero number of these cases, the people fleeing from their country are fleeing because of U.S. imperialism, because they wanted to further their globalist adventures by exploiting foreign countries for their own benefit.
Yeah, like the global South, the whole South, besides Australia, the prison. We're talking about, like, Africa is being currently exploited. South America is being currently exploited. Central America is being exploited. India was exploited till basically, like, the 60s, I think. South Africa to the 80s. I mean, pure exploitation in the paper and documented. South America in the 90s, 2000s, and 2010s, and 2020s.
I mean, you still have the acting Secretary of State recognizing the interim president of Venezuela, even though they had democratic elections and the U.S. coup failed, but they're still recognizing the coup president. But it's all right, because we got somebody that's blue in office now. So you just talked about the Global South, and the Global South is largely going to be the affected party when the U.S. fails to provide enough vaccines for the entire world. The virus will continue to spread and mutate in the Global South, and that will absolutely fuck over the U.S., regardless of whatever their herd immunity or vaccination rate is. So let's talk about COVID variants and how vaccination priority should work. There is this idea in the medical community that there will be another surge. And let's just assume for the sake of argument, there will be. We saw a big spike in November, December, January, and it's significantly leveled off, but you're still having 70,000-ish cases a day and roughly 2,000 deaths. So that's not good. But like the boiling frog, people are largely becoming immune to this and they just want to get back to work. So assuming there is a surge, how do you best allocate resources of the vaccine?
It's a really interesting concept here because you have to understand that variants form when individuals are housing it long enough for it to form the variant, right? How evolution works and how cells divide is that somebody has it, there's a mutation in their blood somewhere, or during a virus replication, the mutation happens. That becomes a predominant virus within the body because of whatever features it has. And now it's allowed to replicate, and then that takes over the body as its response. And then you transmit that out. So there are two ways to think about this, and we talked about this before. One is, if there's going to be another surge, why does that happen? And I think the other surge happens because individuals are going to be complacent with mask mandates because they're going to see the numbers go down. But guess what? It's still 70,000 a day. It's not 100,000 a day. It's still 70,000. That's still a lot of fucking people to get it. But it's not so much to get herd immunity, because 70,000 new cases a day over 100 days is only 7 million people. The United States is 350 million people. So let's just say then that that happens over the course of a year, or let's say 400 days. The math breaks down to being about 30 million people. That's still only 10% of the population of people that are known infected with COVID, where we don't know whether or not asymptomatic, whatever it is. So the number one people that should probably get this are the frontline workers working with the most at-risk patients. All the people that can't get vaccinated who are, you know, basically fragile enough that a virus kills them. The next is that you probably want to find the super spreaders, the dickheads that are always out and about, not wearing masks, and are willing to party. And this could be young people, because it may not kill them, but they are the ones that are in colleges, going to cafes, out hanging with their friends. And it's also the 40-something divorcees that want to go to the bar and drink and listen to country music on the jukebox, I think.
What's a jukebox?
I think that's the thing you put in $7 and you get two songs of memories that you had when you were a kid on the radio, and you had to reminisce while getting drunk, drinking $4 beers.
What's the radio?
The radio is electromagnetic waves that are broadcast out from an antenna that your frequency modulated receiver grabs and then decodes into audio, into like basically, now it's digital, but at the time it was analog signal.
You just outlined some priorities about how vaccine distribution should go. And your first group was effectively minimizing high-risk people, healthcare workers, sick, and elderly. The second was attempting to mitigate the spread, right?
Yep.
What we're up against, and there's a couple different criteria by which you can optimize here, is do you want to decrease the number of cases? Do you want to decrease the number of deaths? Do you want to decrease the amount of mutation? Like, what balance of that do you want? So there are a number of epidemiologists that are throwing out ideas. And one of the prevalent ideas being put forth by people connected with the Biden administration is to use all of the vaccines available on people over the age of 65, give everybody a single dose of the mRNA derivatives, because those seem to have a high success rate on one shot of prevention or mitigating severe illness. So let's say you get a shot and it's 70% effective. I'm making that number up, but it's some number that provides some immunity. So you give all the boomers get as all the vaccines. And the idea behind that is to reduce the number of deaths. So that's one way to do this. And I think we all have concerns about this because we want to minimize death. But in giving all of the old people a vaccine, we're completely negating the potential of a mass mutation event by not actually mitigating the spread of the virus as a result of using sort of scarce resources associated with vaccine.
Absolutely. I don't know why they want to do that. I think the idea is that if you're over 65, you have a high chance of getting death, I guess, from it. But at the same time, the person you got it from is probably your 45-year-old son or daughter, daughter-in-law, son-in-law, doesn't matter who. But it's somebody close to you that's probably of middle-aged who is visiting with you because they're the sandwich generation. They'll take care of their kids while visiting their, you know, their parents. And they're the ones that are out every day, I guess, quote unquote, making the economy grow. So generally at 45, yes, that's your management level. That's whatever the, you know, been in the industry for 20 years mentality. And they're out and about doing stuff. They normally have access to disposable income, so they're going to be out spending it. And they're really probably the highest risk of potential spreaders is actually the 35 to 55 year old band of people. And that, in my mind, is who you should probably target for vaccination. I mean, I said college kids. I mean, you're 20 somethings who are in high density populations of people, like, I don't know, colleges probably should get vaccinated. Individuals who work the frontline places should get vaccinated. People who want to go out and eat and drink and act like an asshole at the bar should be vaccinated. Like, walk in the bar, get stabbed in the arm, go to the free drink.
So there's some short-sightedness to this, there's some temporalness to how we want to optimize this problem. So if we give everybody over the age of 65 a vaccine now, we can prevent their immediate death in, let's say, the next 2 months. And that's good.
Yep.
But as part of doing that, you vaccinate the entire boomer generation, and the first thing they do is, I need to book a trip. I'm going to go to Florida. It's cold. I'm vaccinated. I don't give a shit about anybody else. I'm going to do whatever I want. Like, how does that help mitigate the spread of the virus, and how does that prevent mutations? Because once a mutation happens, everybody that's over the age of 65 that has the vaccine literally has no immunity anymore, and the new mutation just kills all these people anyway. Like, that's a viable outcome, and I don't think it's being considered because we're looking way too short term.
The other thing is you have the stressors of individuals who, under monetary theories, MMT, are psychotically obsessed with things like a balanced budget and no debt. Even though debt doesn't matter, it doesn't matter at all. We've had so much debt that all we've had is inflating the stock market arbitrarily. That's all it is. The only inflation really comes from the stock market because it just gets pumped and dumped into stocks. So if you're Abbott and you just got hit with a major storm, you need to rebuild your economy. What do? You open it up. You open up your economy, right? I don't know why, but you do. So instead of taking out debt, they're going to open it up and they're going to try to bleed off and siphon off basically middle, like, of the tier people's money. The middle class. Like, so the 65 year older who are on fixed incomes will probably go out every day and go to the diner and eat, but it's not really those that are going to spur the economy. It's fixed income. They're not buying houses. They're not buying new cars. They're just going to go out and they're going to go to service industries and peter out money here or there. It's really that middle generation, that 35, the 55, sorry, that have a large disposable income coming out in the PMC class, who are willing to just waste money. That's how you jumpstart the economy. That's it. The idea that you want to, you know, open up Texas without masks, at the same time you're only vaccinating the elderly who go get their nails and hair done once a week, who live in confined areas or don't travel around much because they're elderly, right? Their energy level isn't as high. Their spending capability isn't as high. Means that you've not only created the incentive for individuals who could be hosts and carriers, but you also, you know, didn't arm them with the protection they needed to go and spur your economy. It's a very backwards-ass way of thinking about this mitigation.
And it directly follows a pattern of globalization, which is I, as the imperialist core, want to do as good for myself as possible. So I'm a boomer. I want the vaccine. I'm a policymaker and I'm a boomer, so I want the vaccine. And we're justifying this because we're going to reduce deaths. And that is objectively true, but it's super short-sighted. And it relies on the exploitation of others in order to provide us with the vaccination that we need for 3 months before a mutation hits that absolutely rat fucks us. And that's, again, a short-sighted, pro-isolationist perspective that the boomers are driving that is not going to play out in the long run as being beneficial, which is the same problem with globalization. Same problem at every level from local to national to global. It's exploitation, and those doing the exploiting are actually hurting themselves in the long run because they don't commit to being co-participants. And when shit gets hairy and rough, they revert to isolationism.
This example applies to every single segment, like you said, of the population. There is literal isolationism at the suburbs.
Like, that's why suburbs exist. It's literal isolationism.
It's literal isolationism. You give yourself enough land and housing value that the others cannot buy into it. You create HOAs the others can't afford to maintain their house. You base all of the schools off of property values in your district. You make it illegal for other people to come in from other districts and use your resources. Like, it's a literal isolationist every level you go up. You do it at the county level, right? Our taxes only go towards whatever's happening at the county level. We don't want to have to repay the state because why should someone in the city over there take my money in? You see the isolationists when they say, why should my tax money go to the poor to help them with XYZ, with food stamps or Medicaid? Because they've never lived that way. They don't care, but, you know, it's that isolationist mentality. So again, what can you do? If you listen to every single one of our podcasts, it's join the city council. Be an asshole somewhere, really, is what it comes down to. Because the small steps you take now are going to help break that isolationist idea and globalization, you know, segmentation up the chain. Again, we advocate globalization in the sense that we don't need borders. In our mind, that's what globalization should be. But in reality, under capitalism, globalization means we have the ability to freely move product around for, you know, trade and violating you, but we're not legally allowed to move humans around because that would disrupt globalization on the capitalist side. And that's what the big fight is when it comes down to immigration law. How do you prevent so many people coming from the United States that you can keep your wages higher, your quality of life higher, by violating other people in other countries? That's why there's stipulations, like you have to have $15,000 in your bank account to apply for a visa, a student visa, right? You can't fly an airplane when you're like third trimester, because they don't want you dropping a baby, an anchor baby, they call it, in the United States. You have to be 21 to sponsor your parents to come over if you were born in the United States to sponsor people. They make it really hard to come over here because they want to exploit the low-wage workers in other countries.
So globalization as it exists now can be trivially defined as the flow of products into a country that does not equal the flow of products or goods or benefits out of the country. So the U.S. is just sucking resources globally. And when shit hit the fan with COVID, they're not outputting a similar amount of productivity or goodness externally. So that's exploitation. So what we advocate for globally is this idea of collectivism, where you take in and then you output an equal amount. It's everybody working together in harmony to make everything better. Like it's just a stupid, simple concept, but capitalism doesn't allow it because it's profit seeking.
Yeah, there are neoliberal mentality out there, neoliberal groups that are attempting to help the process. You have the let's take coffee for an example, where it's just pure exploitation. They try to do shade growing. They try to do certified organic. They try to do fair trade. These are all neoliberal groups that try to balance that abusive behavior. But at the end of the day, is it a one for one? It's not. It's a, well, this is what it would be like if you exchange money in the United States over to Guatemala, and the Guatemala had a very similar cost of living, blah, blah, blah. So instead of you're paying $10 a pound for the coffee, instead of the farmer getting $10 a pound, they're getting like 48 cents. And that's the problem with globalization. Because, yeah, it's better than 43 cents, but it's not as good as direct from the source $10, right? Because every place along the way is taking money. The beanery, the packing company, the transportation company, the distribution company, right? Back to more transportation company, not onto the shelves of your supermarket, into your basket. There's a payment every way. There's a 3% drop in payment every single time you make payments. Every single time, and that gets siphoned off. And there is just literal siphoning of money and value the entire way in cap.
The cost of the coffee is $10, and the grower makes 48 cents. So that difference in 9.52 is the surplus value extracted from the labor of the farmer. And you went through and you listed the beanery. And each one of these layers is extracting surplus value from the person actually doing the work. That is capitalism. That is the intent. It extracts value from labor disproportionately to the labor. Globalization scales this nationally. It's exploitation.
Absolute exploitation. You're a capitalist in the turn of the century. You need to, turn of the century is in 1800 to 1900. You need to be able to make more money. The base doesn't grow unless you have more buyers. What do? You basically increase the standard of living for a small segment of other countries around you so they can maybe buy your products a little tiny bit, but also then hold constant or decrease the cost of goods in the United States to get more extraction out of the working class. And that's what globalization is, and that's why it's bad. Actually, it's bad because it's capitalism. Fuck capitalism. There's a lot of problems wrong with it, but at the end of the day, it's a calculated exploitation of not only labor, but also the people that quote-unquote benefit from it. Your wages stagnated from the 70s. Because there's no reason to pay you more money. Because the cost of goods sold stays roughly the same, because they just keep exploiting external labor.
For future episodes and to learn more about the worker movement, join us at workermovement.com.